ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Chit chat, casual conversation, small talk. How do you feel about that style of interaction? It drives some people up the wall. But really, how often do we dive right in with, "Hi, my name's Hilary Harper. Here are my deepest thoughts." And if we did, would people just edge away? This is Life Matters, which we like to think has a combination of the big and the small, the cozy and the challenging. And today we'll find out how important that balance is to a healthy, functioning society. You're hearing us from NAM, Melbourne. How about this weather? If you just shuddered a little bit at that, you're not alone, I'm sure. Small talk certainly gets a bad rap in some circles, and maybe you feel that it's shallow or boring. But the truth is, humans couldn't communicate without it. Let's explore what that means for us, what small talk is for, and how to get better at it, perhaps even come to love it someday. Nick Enfield is with us today. He's a professor of linguistics at the University of Sydney and the author of a book called How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. Nick Enfield, this is completely in my wheelhouse. I'm so happy to be having this discussion today.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me, Hilary.
What's happening when we open with a reference to the weather? What is happening when we do small talk?
Well, I think you can probably predict if we open with a reference to the weather that the person we're talking to is a stranger or somebody that we, you know, aren't particularly close to. So that's often what small talk denotes, is that, you know, maybe it's someone at the bus stop or it's someone at the reception as we come in to a building or something like that. And that's one of the reasons why people feel slightly allergic to it, because they feel that it's associated with a certain social distance. But I disagree. I think that, you know, there's a matter of knowing who you should be doing small talk with, and we can discuss that. But I think what's really valuable about it is that it kicks off an interaction. It's a way to find some common ground with someone who you've never met. And, you know, that's a very important little bit of social lubricant when we live in the massive societies that we live in and we're often talking to complete strangers.
I totally see how that works. And I was thinking about how much I missed those small, apparently meaningless conversations during lockdowns when we couldn't kind of get out and brush up against strangers in the supermarket or the cafe or whatever. But don't we also do it with people we do know? I mean, we often kind of tick off a few little boxes about, you know, the kids and the partner and how's your work thing when you catch up with your friends and family.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'd call those things small talk. I guess there is a matter of kind of opinion there. But, you know, the opposite end of small talk might be something like, you know, deep and meaningful. We're talking about the meaning of life and this kind of thing. But there's a lot of stuff between that. And if we're talking about just some bit of practicality to do with kids, it's not exactly small talk in that it's part of organizing our lives. If it's got to do with, you know, talking about a movie that we saw, this kind of thing, it might feel a bit like small talk, but what we're often doing is expressing how we feel about that experience that we had, and it gives you an opportunity to align with the other person and, you know, well, I liked it just like you did, or I had the same view as you had, and that might help us to kind of cement who we are to each other in some kind of way. If you go too far with that, if you're talking about stuff that's too light on for the relationship you're in with that person, well, that's when people start to kind of complain about it, that it's not perhaps revealing enough about the person's personality or feelings when such a revealing would be appropriate.
Wow. So that sounds like you need quite a finely tuned social radar to work out in what circumstances and at what degree of closeness you should be revealing which kinds of information.
Yeah, exactly. So we live in very complex forms of society, and it doesn't matter sort of when in history or where you lived. It's not just because we live in, for example, myself living in the middle of a big city. Anybody, anywhere is part of a kind of an onion skin style of kind of set of relationships. So at the very core, you've got, you know, your closest people who support you. One level out, you have people who you tend to rely on quite a lot. Another level out, it sort of goes out in these levels. And we need to know how to behave with people who are in those respective levels to keep that calibrated, to be sort of appropriate in the things that we choose to talk about. And you're right, people are very, very well calibrated and sensitive to these things. So take an example of the kind of thing that you really should tell someone in your inner circle before you tell someone in your outer circle. So you might take a pregnancy test and find out that you're pregnant. Now, who's the first person you're going to tell? Are you just going to tell random people on the street? Are you going to tell, you know, your dentist or maybe your student if you're teaching a class? Are you going to put it on Instagram? You maybe should talk to your partner,
maybe,
or people who are closer to you before you kind of advertise that information. And so that's a sort of an extreme end of the scale, the opposite of small talk, really, announcing that you've become pregnant or you've lost your job or whatever, big news. But there's a lot, as I said, between that and how's the weather, and we're very careful to calibrate those. Another example would be just aches and pains and kind of health issues. You don't tend to talk to those to, you know, the person at reception as you walk into the ABC building. But you should talk to, if you withhold that sort of talk from people who you know well, then they get to feel that you're being overly distant from them and this kind of thing. So there's a great sensitivity to calibrating the subject matter with the kind of relationship we have with someone.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I feel that Tricia at reception and I have quite a bond now. I've forgotten my past a lot of times and we've had a lot of conversations. So yeah, point taken. We're speaking with Nick Enfield, who's a professor of linguistics at the University of Sydney and the author of a book called How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation, looking at the role of small talk. And Nick, it sounds like it's not so much about the type of information that's being transmitted. It's not the information explicitly itself. It's some other layer of information is being exchanged when we do small talk.
Yeah, well, it's a combination. I think some the kinds of things I was just discussing are about the content of the information, but there are certainly other layers of meaning. So one of those layers of meaning is just if you spend time talking to someone, no matter what you talk about, whether it's, you know, the footy or the weather or, you know, whatever it is, you are, by virtue of having that conversation with them, you're devoting a stretch of time to spending time with them. And that you know, you mentioned earlier how we mark kind of social relationships. Well, many creatures that don't have language will mark close social relations by doing things like grooming. So monkeys and apes will often spend time kind of scratching each other's backs. And it's not really designed to clean their skin, or it might do that a bit. It's actually much more, it has a much more important function, which is that it displays who they're prepared to kind of devote their time with. It takes time, right? And if you can't have two conversations at once. So if you're having a conversation with someone, then it indicates that you're willing to spend that time with them. Now, some small talk, of course, happens because, you know, you're waiting, for example, at the bus stop. You can't do something else with that time, so you strike up a bit of conversation. But a lot of the time, stopping, spending a minute talking to someone, that shows, whatever it is that you talk about, shows you have an interest in kind of forming that relationship. And if you get to know, for example, you work in a company, you get to know the people at reception, you get to know the people in admin, well, you know, people notice that and appreciate that, and you do that through what people sometimes call small talk. And if you avoid it, then you don't build a relationship, however superficial that might be, with those people, because you're evidently not prepared to give up the time even to talk about the weather.
Really fascinating texts coming in as we're speaking, Nick. Kate says, living by myself, I find I have lost the art or ability for continual small talk. I can discuss a subject and then find I can't think of anything to say, or I say something inappropriate according to them. So I find I don't mix much at all now, says Kate. And it sounds like, as Nick was saying, that practice really does help in that situation. You've got to hone those skills. Small talk works differently in small scale societies, says another text, whereas there is great familiarity. That's a really interesting point, isn't it, Nick? I'm wondering how transactional we feel about small talk or about our conversation in general in our particular society. Is that one of the reasons why some people find it boring or think it's useless?
Well, I suppose, you know, by transactional, I'm not sure quite what you mean with that.
Well, just that you're more interested in explicit information, useful information that's being transferred, or you don't see small talk and social bonding as important.
Oh, I see.
It's more about, yeah.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So transactional as in, you know, I just want to extract information from you and I'll give you information.
Yeah, and where is this going to get me?
Well, it shows, you know, that language has many layers. And so one of the things that it does do is transfer information, often valuable information. And if that's all you're interested in, then you're treating other people like, you know, you would treat your computer or sort of, you know, the internet or something. And so, you know, that's the other danger. If you don't engage in sufficient small talk, well, people will feel that you're kind of being extractive. I mean, it's interesting to look at the difference with small-scale societies, as your text raised. People in those kinds of societies do indeed know each other very well, so you don't have that kind of challenge of anonymous people nearly so much. But you certainly do have a lot of kind of what seemingly mundane chit-chat about very, you know, they'll be talking about things that have gone on in the fields. They were out doing their farming during the day and kind of recounting experiences or recounting events that everybody was present for. So you're not exactly informing yourselves, but it has that sense of sort of going back over events and building a common understanding of what happened. So an example might be just somebody carried out a certain action. Maybe they, you know, cut a tree that shouldn't have been cut or something like that. And having a bit of small talk about that allows everyone to just gauge each other's reaction and feeling towards that, even though it seems like a minor matter. We're very sensitive. We remember what people thought and felt. And small talk allows us to kind of air all those little opinions and calibrate to each other.
Lovely text here from Anna in Melbourne. Often when I walk past people in my neighbourhood, I smile and have a little chat. Sometimes my six-year-old says, "Why did you just chat with them or smile at them? They're a stranger." And I try to explain to them the purpose of small talk as a way to connect or make people feel nice, which is exactly what we're hearing from Nick Enfield, who's a professor of linguistics at the University of Sydney. His book's called How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. I wanted to ask too, Nick, about the gender differences, perhaps in the approach to small talk, how we do it, but also how it's perceived.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, oftentimes the stereotype, I suppose, would be that, you know, men are interested in things and women are interested in relationships. So that would certainly suggest that, you know, that women are going to be more likely to engage in small talk. But I doubt that because I think that, you know, all human beings are very invested in maintaining social relations of the right kind. And all you have to do is talk to a couple of blokes at some period after the football game and, you know, you can hear them kind of small talking in very much the sense I was just describing. So, you know, if we've both watched the same footy game, we know what happened, we know the outcome. But we can talk about it for an hour. And what we're doing is sort of, you know, a combination of showing off what we noticed, displaying our knowledge, but also those functions I mentioned earlier, which is, you know, allowing you to see, well, which players do I think are poor and which do I think are good. And so it's all really about bonding. So,
and as
I think,
you said, it really is about working out whether your values align, isn't it? That kind of example is really a good one for that.
Yeah, exactly. So recounting experiences is very important for that. And it's something that we spend a lot of time doing in conversation is telling each other stories that could be, you know, seemingly very superficial or mundane, but they allow us to gauge each other, sound each other out and kind of put money in the bank in a sense in terms of just our knowledge about each other. And later on another occasion, we can draw on that information that came out during a, you know, a sort of a bit of light conversation, but it allows us to point to that common ground and kind of recall, oh yeah, we've spoken on many occasions, and that shows that we're more than just strangers.
Yep. I did wonder too, Nick, about the tendency of some people to dismiss small talk as idle chit-chat and useless. Is there a gendered aspect to that? As some feminist scholars have argued in the past, that, you know, this kind of social bonding is often dismissed and often performed by women.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a danger in mixing the stereotypes from, you know, what really happens. And that's in a way one of the important kind of dangers that someone might want to point out there, that I don't think we want to kind of recommend or demonize small talk or other kind of conversational practices in terms of, let's say, stereotypes around them to do with gender or other kinds of stereotypes. I mean, I think that there's a lot of personal difference as well, a lot of individual variance, which I think would be quite a lot more, quite a lot greater than that sort of between different social groups. So one of your texts earlier was about somebody who is, you know, living a certain lifestyle on their own that makes a much bigger difference to the kinds of small talk they'll engage in. And we all know that, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, there's a great variance in personality, that some people are excellent at small talk. They're very engaging. They're very proactive about it. Other people are super shy and kind of hold back. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of reasons why some people engage more in small talk than others, and picking them apart's a, you know, really interesting puzzle.
Yes, indeed. I love some of these texts coming from really different perspectives on small talk, Nick. One says, I prefer connection by small talk over connection by complaining. I hate it when people use random bitching to try to make a connection. Interesting use of words there too. Molly in St. Lucia says, now that I'm retired and don't go out much and mix much, my small talk is done daily via text with the network of people around me. Small talk at bus stops, says another text. Sadly, it's greatly withered with everyone using earbuds. And this one too, I used to be hopeless at small talk. For work, I learned small talk as a preamble to a meeting. And I then discovered this is the place to learn lots about people without cross-examination and the context for the meetings. Some of those clients are now friends. Small talk is the glue to the relationships. Is small talk a way of kind of easing the pressure if you're going to have bigger conversations with those people afterwards, Nick?
Yeah, very much is, if it's done right. And I think that, you know, that example of a business meeting is a really good one where, you know, every conversation that you have has got a time course, right? So it starts at a certain point, it builds over time. At a certain point, oftentimes you've got to get to a certain bit of business, you know, the real reason why you're having the meeting or the real reason why you're having the call. And everything up to that point has kind of prepared you for that. And so the small talk serves that kind of function. There's a very interesting study done in the US of parents or caregivers taking children to doctors, to GP's offices to get just for doctor's appointments for coughs and colds. And they found that there was a problem that oftentimes the children, at a, you know, the key moment, they would get asked a question by the doctor and they just wouldn't answer, they wouldn't speak. So the researchers looked at these conversations and they found that if the doctor at the beginning of the consultation directs a couple of questions to the kid, just like, oh, is that your teddy bear? What's its name? Or, you know, did you play sport on the weekend? Just total small talk. If they direct a couple of questions the kid's way at the very beginning, then they're much more likely later in the consultation to answer questions that are about the real business, or how do you feel, have you got pain, or what's wrong with you kind of thing. So that, I think, is a really good demonstration of how small talk opens up a channel. It kind of starts some gears rolling, and then they're open for when the kind of real business has to begin. And very often, whether it's a work situation or another situation, there's some real business that's got to be done at some point, and this is all kind of lubricant for that.
Yeah, there's a great text on that, Nick, that says, I joined a mother's group years ago and discerned quite quickly that there was one woman there who was on the other end of the political spectrum to me. But gently, through weekly catch-ups as a group and connecting over children and activities, we were able to broach other deeper topics that I don't think we could have straight off the bat. Well, I was struck too by what Kate said earlier, Nick, about, you know, I live alone and I'm a bit rusty at it. How can we improve? And I guess the cornerstone to that is, what does good small talk look like?
Well, improvement, I think, is like with every other skill, it's practice, and it takes, you know, going out and doing the practice, and there's plenty of opportunities for that if you get out and about. You know, there are people who have opportunities to talk. I find myself striking up conversations all over the place for fun, and, you know, things happen that are really interesting. I think the question of, you know, whether it's working or not, well, your best gauge of that, your best measurement of that is the response of the other human being, right? So, you know, of course, some of us are more or less sensitive to how others respond. But, you know, it's like everything. You get out there, you try it, and you see what the results were, and, you know, you try to either repeat when it went well, or you try to adjust if it didn't go quite so well. But as with everything, practice makes perfect.
Yes, indeed. And good luck to you, Kate, and to anyone else who might feel they need to exercise those small talk muscles. Nick, it's been fascinating chatting with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Nick Enfield, Professor of Linguistics at the University of Sydney. His book is called How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. And I'm really grateful to you for sending in so many varied and nuanced texts on this as well. Kelly in Lismore says, in an Indigenous context, yarning starts with social yarning, which is basically small talk, catching up, setting the scene. It's considered rude to jump into serious business without setting the scene in that way. Lloyd says, as a gardener, I talk about the weather with my colleagues multiple times a day. It helps us plan for the day. It's a way of looking out for each other. We warn each other of rain or wind, for example, or remind each other to wear sunscreen. And Lloyd says, I sometimes get pushback from my non-outdoor working friends who write it off as small talk. Dean from Templestowe says, I try small talk, but conversations on the weather turn to climate, work turns to class, and learning to our two-tiered education system. Is that a bad thing, Dean, if it eventually gets there? I don't know. Thanks so much for your contributions here on Life Matters. Up next, another conversation I think a lot of us are going to be interested in. Does wearing spectacles make your eyesight worse in the long run? We'll get an optometrist to weigh in on that on RN.
Are you an early career PhD researcher, or do you know someone who is? It's time to apply for this year's ABC Top 5. This is a unique opportunity for outstanding scientists, humanities academics, artists, and cultural researchers. You could be one of the amazing people we get to meet to spend 2 weeks with the ABC, learning about the media and communicating your amazing research. Find full details online. Just search for ABC Top 5 to apply.
If you wear prescription glasses, you'll know that feeling of putting on a new pair and suddenly everything feels sharp and clear. I felt like the world had been washed the first time I put mine on. But when you take them off, it can feel like your eyesight is terrible. Could it actually be getting worse the longer you wear your specs? Let's find out how much of that is in our eyes and how much is in our minds. James Armitage is a professor of optometry at Deakin University, and he's here to explain this and answer any other questions that you might have about eye health. James, welcome.
Morning, Hilary. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Why does it sometimes feel like our eyesight gets worse after we start wearing glasses? What's going on?
Well, let's step back to what a pair of glasses do. First of all, they take light from outside in the world, wherever it may be, whether it's far off in the distance or close up on a book or on our phone. And our eye, through an autofocus system with a muscle that moves around a lens, puts that image from way out in the world exactly where it should be on our retina, and we get a nice crisp image. And many of us, myself included, need a pair of glasses in the distance to help us focus light where it should go on the retina. And so when we first get a pair of glasses, we say, oh my goodness, I can see, everything's clear. And then we get used to that clarity and we get used to seeing well. And then when we take them off, you think, oh, it's got a heap worse, but it hasn't really. It's just you've become far less tolerant of that blurry vision.
Yes, I'm very intolerant of that blurry vision, I find, over time. But it is a weird feeling, isn't it? Particularly, I guess, when we take our close-up glasses off and then it feels like maybe it's hard to focus on things further away. Is that something that we should worry about?
Again, probably not, because for most of us, we have this autofocus system works quite well. And as we get older, the lens inside of our eye moves from being a really flexible rubbery lens that can be moved around really easily to this sort of hard lump of wood that sits there and does very little when the muscle tries to move it around. So that's why we don't see so well up close. But for most of us, from probably the age of 40 or thereabouts, when we start to wear glasses for reading, our muscle's still doing a little bit, and it's just a bit of a, there's sort of a bit of a sliding wedge where we go from being totally able to focus up close to totally unable to working, able to focus up close. And our glasses, the optometrists will just change your glasses over time so that there's a combination of you being able to change your focus and the glasses helping you out. So it's a bit like a crutch for about 15 years until we need to just wear reading glasses.
Great. Okay, I've made my peace with that now. Is there anything we can do about that age-related change to our eyes?
Not really in terms of the lens. So many people wouldn't realise this, but the lens inside our eye is one of the oldest structures in our whole body. So way back when we're just a few weeks old in our mother's womb, cells in the lens, or what will become the lens, have this sort of chemical chat with cells that are going to become the brain. And between the two of them, they sort themselves out, and the lens actually starts this formation of the eye. And over time, our lens gets bigger. We just, like a tree, rings on a tree, we just keep adding more and more cells to our lens. And so right in the middle of our lens are the oldest cells in our whole body. And you can imagine they can't get their waste products out very well. And so over time, it just becomes a little dirty, a little cloudy. As I said, it loses its flexibility. And it's just I think it's an honour of becoming a little older that we've got these changes, because, as I said, these are the oldest cells in our body.
Mm. Well, and yeah, we pay little sacrifices as the years go on for the privilege of ageing, I know, but I prefer it over the alternative. A few Correct. Practical questions, James. Do you need to wear glasses all the time if you need them for close-up work or particular things?
So what I usually tell people is wear them, in terms of close-up work, wear them when you need them. If you're in your early mid-40s and you've got your first pair of glasses, then maybe for most of the day you'll be fine, or if you're holding things a little bit further away, you'll be fine. But if you can't see what you're reading, put them on. So it's very much for reading glasses. It's very much if you're doing well and you don't feel like you need them, it's okay, you don't need to wear them. And when you need them, you wear them. That's for adults, of course, which is really, really different to kids.
Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah, yeah. I think we'll mainly be talking about adults today. Perhaps children are another interview on another day. Lisa's texted in saying, I wear glasses for working on my PC or reading prices and ingredients in the supermarket. I find my sight becoming worse without glasses now. I also find the more sugar I have in my diet, the worse my sight becomes. What's your view on those things, the effects of diet on vision, and whether or not it's sight becoming worse without glasses? Is that just an age-related change for Lisa?
Yeah, so just again, imagine, Lisa, that you're over whatever it might be, 15 years from about 40 till about 55, or perhaps it's 20 years. Our eyes are going to need more and more help to read up close. And so if you say, gosh, 3 years ago, I could do a lot better reading this up close than I can now, it must be my glasses. It's not. It's just that there was that inevitable change over the last 3 years, and your glasses have been making up for it. As I said, they're a bit of a crutch. So it's not that. Your eyes are not getting worse because of your glasses. Your eyes are doing what they were going to do, and the optometrist has just been basically compensating for it. Now, in terms of diet can absolutely change vision, and some of my PhD studies, which feels 300 or 400 years ago, looked at the role of essential fatty acids in diet. And we do know that the diet we consume over a lifetime can either improve our chances of delaying macular degeneration or cataract, or perhaps increase the risk, as will smoking. People with diabetes can have quite large fluctuations in their prescription. And that's because when we have diabetes, our body's less able to control sugar and how much sugar is in our body and in our blood. And if our sugar goes up, then water will follow it because by a process of osmosis, and there'll be changes in lens power. For the average person who doesn't have diabetes, if you have a big if you have a big meal with lots and lots of sugars in it, our pancreas sorts out our blood glucose level with insulin, and so you shouldn't really experience any changes in your vision because of sugar consumption, but certainly people with diabetes can. So
okay,
it'd be worthwhile just going and checking if you know your sugars are nice and stable after having lots of sugar.
Well, I imagine if seeing any change to your vision, particularly some blurriness, that would be a signal to go and see an optometrist.
Yeah, and there's a suggestion that the most causes of blindness in Australia, that's macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, glaucoma, cataract. If they're picked up relatively early, then there are treatments that can slow progression, and therefore, the quicker someone says, "Oh, my vision's not quite as good as it was," the quicker that we can assess the eyes, see if it is just glasses need changing, or whether there is something that's perhaps driving that change in vision, and you need to go and think about a treatment for that. Because whilst we can prevent loss of vision quite effectively in many cases, once it's changed and once the retina is damaged, it's pretty hard to, well, it's almost impossible at the moment to get any improvement.
That may change as science continues its march forwards, we hope. We're speaking with James Armitage, who's a professor of optometry at Deakin University, who's answering our questions about eyes and glasses. And lots of questions via text, James. When I have had a cold, my vision is not so sharp. Is that fluid in the eyes?
No, it's your tear film. So our tears actually drain through a little, it's called a punctum, little hole on our lid, and it actually drains back into the back of our nose. So when we have a cold, there's actually a little tube that's linking our eyes to our nose. And so if we've got, if that's blocked because we've got a blocked nose way up in the top of your nose, then your tears don't drain well. And your tears are actually the very first surface that light hits as it enters our eye, a little bit like, the windscreen on your car is the first surface that light hits when you're on its way to you when you're driving. And so if you've got an uneven tear film because you've got lots of tears in there, they're not draining very well, or you've got a little bit of a conjunctivitis secondary to your cold, then you can end up having a sort of a lumpy tear film, which distorts some of our vision. So lots of blinking usually helps. But that's definitely a known thing. As your tear film gets a little bit wobbly, so does your vision.
Mm. And Jill asks, does using magnifying glasses ruin eyes more than prescription glasses?
No. The only thing I would say is that the readers that you may get from the pharmacist or a non-prescribed pair are pretty much a little bit like going and buying clothes off the rack. They may work for some people, they may not work for other people. Certainly if you have a pair of glasses made to your prescription, taking into account the left eye, the right eye and all those other things, they'll be more comfortable. But the other thing that I sort of say to people is if you are going to just use those magnifiers, that's fine if they're doing the job, but make sure you're getting your eyes checked, because a lot of people think about optometrists as the people who give you the glasses, and we do, but we're actually the primary eye care health professionals in Australia. That's the way optometry operates. And so it's really, you should be going in for your regular checks just to make sure that everything is healthy.
Yeah, and you can always take that prescription and go find cheaper lenses somewhere, a cheaper frame somewhere else. That's often the key thing for people that puts them off, I find. James, are there adverse effects to going without glasses in the long term if you do need them, if you're just kind of holding your phone or your book further and further away until your arm runs out of space?
Yeah, no. Sore neck, sore back, sore shoulders are the main things that you'll get as an adult, say, 40 to 60. You're not going to do any damage to your eyes by not having the right pair of glasses, you just can't see. As I said, children, it's really important that kids have got good even vision between the left eye and the right eye, because as our eyes and our brain grow up till kids are probably, maybe even up to about 10, but certainly in that 5 to 7 age, there's active changes in the way each eye is wiring up to the brain. And so it's really important that kids have the right pair of glasses if they need them, and that their eyes are aligned correctly, that there's not one sort of pointing a little bit left or a little bit higher than where it should be. But for the average adult, you'll feel uncomfortable, you'll get a headache, you'll get eye strain. If you can then, you know, go and have a rest or whatever, then you'll probably feel a bit better.
Margaret texts in, "It's not your eyes. The lighting is just not as good as it used to be." Thank you, Margaret.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, in the old days. And a final question, James, do eye rolling exercises help improve your vision?
I don't think there's any evidence that they do, no. So lots of people do, that there'll be stuff on social media about doing certain things and it'll improve your eyesight. Largely, there's no evidence for any of those exercises. If you need to do particular training exercises, and it's usually to do with your eyes not changing focus the way they should, or perhaps our left eye and our right eye not moving around the world as they should in concert, so we get a nice clear single image, then yes, a set of tailored exercises can work. But the eye rolling and the eye rubbing and the staring at the sun and all of those things are either, you know, no help, or certainly in terms of staring at the sun, perhaps unhelpful.
I'll finish with this text from someone who says, "My husband had to wear glasses from the age of 8 to 45. His eyes then became normal with perfect 20/20 vision. He's now in his late 60s and still has perfect vision. Jealous." And I would say probably not representative. James, it's lovely to have you on the program. Thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us on Life Matters.
Thanks a lot, Hilary.
Pleasure. James Armitage is a professor of optometry at Deakin University. Right, you're middle-aged, you've got a dicky knee and a restless longing is stirring inside you. Of course, I'm going to do an 800-kilometre walk in Spain. We'll talk to that person next on Life Matters.
New from ABC Books.
Huddled together, the Australian nurses told each other to be brave no matter what.
Lieutenant Colonel Vivian Bullwinkle was the sole survivor of a horrendous war crime in World War II. But it's what she did after that made Sister Viv an Australian icon.
Vivian's story shaped how the nurses of Australia define themselves.
Sister Viv, by the award-winning Grant Lee Keyser. Book and audiobook available in bookstores and online.
As you move through life, it can be easy to get caught up in your own concerns, perhaps even to the exclusion of others around you. But you might also find a kind of yearning rising up in you for something bigger, something more to life. Film director Bill Bennett found himself thinking a lot about the Camino de Santiago, which is many hundreds of kilometres long and crosses multiple countries. He's made a film about it. It's very brave and very funny. It's called The Way, My Way, and it's based on the book that he wrote after he did his very own pilgrimage. Bill Bennett, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you.
And Johnny Walker Santiago is with us too. He's walked the Camino dozens of times, taking many different paths, and he's written a series of guides and books about the walk. Johnny, great to have you on the program.
Good morning.
I'm wondering if you've hiked the Camino de Santiago, or even just a section of it, because it's very long. What did it mean to you to tread those ancient paths, as so many others have done before you over the centuries? And make me jealous, because I've wanted to do this for a very long time, and various things have intervened. So I'm very interested to hear how it worked out for you, Bill. Hello.
G'day.
Now, I mean, what drew you to this? Because you've said it wasn't an issue of faith, and it wasn't a kind of nebulous finding yourself idea. What was it?
I really honestly didn't know. I had been in Spain, northern Spain, on holidays with my wife. I'd seen these people walking, what turned out to be the Del Norte. I got talking to them and discovered that they were walking this 800-kilometre pilgrimage walk. I asked a lot of them why they were doing it. They didn't really know. And I came away thinking, what a stupid, meaningless, crazy thing to do. and it immediately appealed to me. And so I just had to do it. But I did the walk really not knowing why.
Wait a minute. You booked the flight, you found your stick, you packed your bag, all without not knowing why you were heading off to Spain.
Yeah, it was a real mystery to me. It genuinely was. And I was hoping that during the walk that the reason would become apparent to me. And it didn't. I got to Santiago at the end after, for me, a torturous walk because I had problems with my knee. And I was expecting an epiphany, sort of a bolt from heaven.
Yeah, you know, atheist heaven.
telling me why I'd done this. And really, I had to go home and write the book to get closure on what I'd done.
We'll come back to this, but Johnny, I want to know from you, do you remember what drew you out that first time? Because you've walked it so many times now.
I remember exactly. Around about the year 2000, I'd been doing very difficult jobs, and like you, I wanted something on my bucket list to change my life. The chairman of the board of the company of which I was the chief executive invited me to dinner. And I went to the big house, rang the doorbell. He opened the door and he said, "Come into the drawing room."
What does it look like?
So I went into the drawing room, and there on the wall was a map of what I now know to be the Camino Francés. And there were three photographs of his wife, Jenny, walking along. She'd done it in three stages. And over dinner, she spoke about the blisters, the fellowship, the albergues, the scenery, the food, the feeling of freedom. And the seed was planted. It took four more years for me thinking about this and dreaming and calculating my pension fund as to when I could do it. So I wasn't entirely sure why I embarked on this journey, but it's changed everything.
Well, yeah, and that happens for people, doesn't it? The seed is planted and then years later they might get there. How prepared are they when they do get there, in your experience?
Well, people don't have to be terribly prepared. Because you can go slowly, you can walk a few kilometres in the first few days, get used to it. Of course, it's best to have done some training before you go, preparing your gear, make sure you've got all the stuff. Not too much, Hilary. You've got to take as little as possible. The less weight you carry, the better your feet will be.
Well, and I was just laughing out loud when I saw the bit in the film, Bill Bennett, where you're weighing your undies on your wife's kitchen scales to try and get your pack down under 10% of your body weight. And her response was very hilarious. Tell us a bit about your wife's attitude to this whole project.
Well, when I first told her that I wanted to walk the Camino de Santiago, we were actually in a restaurant, and she laughed so much she spurted her food all out over the table. And my children had a very similar response. They thought that it was a passing fad and that there was no way in the world that I would do it. But when I finally booked the ticket and bought my backpack, even then she found it very difficult to believe.
Well, yeah. I mean, she knew you. She knew your knee.
Hilary, I'm a stupid person, really. I'm a very stupid person because what I did is I overtrained. And in overtraining, I flared up a knee injury quite badly. And I remember getting to, I landed in Biarritz, close to the starting point. And I remember facing these stairs in the airport thinking, I've got to walk up these stairs. And if I can't walk up these stairs, I can't walk up the Pyrenees tomorrow.
How long did you stay at the bottom of the stairs before you made the first step?
It was nuts. I had this very strong belief that my knee would come good if I walked 800K.
Okay.
Yeah, like I say, I'm stupid.
Well, he's certainly stubborn, Bill Bennett, as you will see if you watch the film, which is called The Way, My Way, The Way being a reference to the Camino de Santiago in Spain, but also France and several other countries, I understand.
Well, no, only two. So the Camino Francés starts off in a place called Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, which is on the French side of the Pyrenees. And then on the very first day, you climb the Pyrenees into Spain, and then the rest of it is in Spain.
Johnny Walker Santiago, your view? I saw a funny facial expression flit across you just then.
Traditionally, people in the Middle Ages walk from their homes. So there are routes from all of the major European countries. including Ireland and Wales and Scotland and so forth. And some people are still travelling these routes. So they can start in Stockholm and walk to Santiago.
Wow. So it's like a kind of giant octopus just converging.
Absolutely. And all of the routes in Europe converge into five routes in Spain. Bill's right. The Camino Francés, the Camino del Norte, the Camino Inglés, and so forth.
So what kind of changes do you see in people, Johnny? Because you've written guides and books, you've walked the walk a lot of times. How do you see it change people?
Well, people change if they want to change. The advice that I give people is the essential component that you need to put in your rucksack is an open mind and be prepared to embrace the experiences which you have. You know, some people, about a third of people walk for religious reasons. And the pilgrimage was originally a religious pilgrimage. That means 66% walk for a variety of reasons. To find themselves, for sporting, like you, a hard-pressed radio presenter.
So hard. My life is so hard.
You need time off, time to yourself. The concept of pilgrimage is time apart from your usual life, that you're walking towards a holy place. Not necessarily for religious reasons.
Well, and I think even non-religious people want the idea of something bigger than themselves, and this is certainly a very big thing. I was struck by one bit of the walk, Bill, the Meseta, which is a couple of hundred kilometres of flat and open and largely featureless landscape, and a lot of people choose to skip it. But it was really important for you. Why?
Very important. It's to me, it is the essence of the Camino, because... for me, what happened, it is largely flat. There's long distances between villages. And what happens, Hilary, is that when you walk and you get into this sort of hypnotic space because you have the sound of your walking stick, tick, 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 tick. You have the sound of your breathing. The wind sweeps in over the plains. And I found it to be a very cleansing time. But also it's a place of contemplation. And you do get into a walking meditation just with this sort of metronomic beat that sort of takes over your whole system.
Well, yeah, but your metronome was a bit wonky by the end, wasn't it, or at various points? How did you keep going on that knee?
Look, I was told I went to an orthopaedic surgeon when I came back. I had scans and so forth. He said, you're bone on bone, you don't have any cartilage. How did you walk this distance? He said, and I remember his words, he said, it's a miracle you've walked this distance. And I'll give you a little secret how I did it. Coke Zero and ibuprofen.
And willpower.
And lots of ibuprofen.
But those are externalities, aren't they? I mean, there was something in you that made you go, it's worth this crunching noise that was apparent in the film. My producers just nearly vomited. But it's true, you know, that there's something driving you inside.
It is true. I remember thinking to myself at one point during the walk that if I have to have... titanium knee placed in my leg, then it will be worth it. I'm going to finish this walk. I was absolutely determined to. But, Hilary, as you saw in the film, I had this sort of, how could you say, a little bit like a hare in a greyhound race. A person that I met on the very first day lent me his towel to wrap my knee in ice. And I got it in my head that I would give this towel back to this fellow. He was leaving Santiago on a particular day to go back to Hungary. And I just had this as this sort of irrational fixed goal. And what it meant was that I was walking sometimes 42, 43 kilometres a day to get this towel back to this fellow. And really it was nonsensical. I could have posted it to him. He didn't need the towel back. But it was this mechanism that I needed to get me there.
Yeah. And I mean, when I think about it, that's 10, 12, possibly longer hour days.
Yeah.
Johnny Walker Santiago, you will have seen a lot of people walk the trail.
Yes.
And a lot of different styles of walking. How many people kind of drive through, you know, and try and get there fast? And how many people just take their time and maybe don't even think about finishing the whole thing. Just go, I'm gonna see where this takes me.
Yeah. Stupid people and Germans.
Yeah. Or
drive themselves. No, they do. They do actually. They're driven people who walk very fast. The rest of us stop and smell the roses. And that's what always I would advise people to do. It's a wonderful experience.
So even if you just walk a section, is that going to give you that sense of separation and of, I don't know, doing something larger than the mundane?
Well, traditionally, the Camino de Santiago is a long-distance walk. It's a long-distance trek. And, of course, Australians don't travel 22,000 kilometres to walk for 3 days. They tend to walk for a month or 6 weeks or even longer. People in the European countries can walk the Camino at a weekend. So they do it every weekend for several years until they reach Santiago or their week's holiday or when the schools are on holiday. So it's there for everyone to do whatever they want to do.
So how do you write a guide to the Camino, given that, I guess, people come to it with such different motivations and walk it in such different ways?
Well, the history of the Camino is compelling in itself. My guidebooks are start at the corner and walk 100 yards and turn left at the oak tree. So my job is to make sure that people don't get lost. And actually, they don't get lost because the routes are very well signposted, as you will find, Hilary, when you put on your walking shoes and come to Spain.
Might have to deal with some thorny childcare issues along the way, but yes, it's definitely on the bucket list. I'm getting some very extensive knee strapping. Bill Bennett, tell us a bit more about what happened when you got home, because you decided to write this book. What changes did you start to feel percolating within yourself and maybe changing how things were around you?
Sorry, probably the biggest change was humility, because because of this pain that I had during the walk, it humbled me incredibly. I mean, I had in my preparation, I'm a very empirical person, you know, so I work out exactly how far I can go, what my distance is, what my heartbeat is, and so forth. And so before I had this sort of flare-up of my knee, I thought, I'm going to crush this. I'm going to smash it out of the park. And then I found myself being passed by 80-year-old women.
Yeah, don't get between an 80-year-old woman and a coffee.
That's right. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, all of my thoughts of how I would approach this Camino were just thrown out the window because of this pain. And so the pain was incredibly humbling. And I brought that humility back with me. I found myself, very strangely, I found myself writing emails, and instead of signing off best wishes, I would say thanks. Just little things like that. And that stayed with me still.
Was it a sense of gratitude for your life in a broader sense?
Yeah, I didn't realise it at the time. And one of the things about the Camino is that it has resonance that lasts for years and years. Sometimes they say that everyone who walks the Camino has a question. They may not realise they have a question, but they have a question that the Camino will answer. And sometimes that question is answered months or years later.
Yes, well, and I think that's turning up in our text messages, which we'll finish with today. When I did 6 days on the Camino in 2015 with my son Greg, says Carolyn, backpacks, etc., I had moments like this, she says, trudging along beside kiwi fruit orchards in Spain by myself for about an hour. I thought, this is me, walking alone in Spain, alone and safe as a pyramid. That's from Carolyn in Tygum. And I guess it just shows you the kinds of things that bubble up from deep within you when you set yourself outside your usual life. Johnny Walker Santiago, Bill Bennett, thanks both of you so much for coming into Life Matters today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Bill Bennett's made a film about his experiences on the Camino. It's called The Way, My Way. Johnny Walker Santiago has written guides to the Camino and walked it many times. You're listening to Life Matters. The film is out on the 16th of May, but there are screenings over the next few days in Victoria, South Australia and Western Australia as well, featuring Q&As with Bill and Johnny. You can check online for details. We've been looking at the power of place today, in a way, and on our next episode, how can we deal with the impact of terrible events in a particular place? A shopping centre and a church were the scenes of two violent attacks in Sydney in recent weeks. Is there a way for us to process trauma when it becomes tied to a place that's familiar and where we thought we were safe? You might think of the history of violence embedded in landscapes around Australia in different contexts. Port Arthur might spring to mind too. We'll draw on those insights about place and trauma and healing here on Life Matters on RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.